Hello, and welcome to Living Vertical Radio, where we change the narrative of media by introducing you to creative and innovative individuals that inspire you with their unique stories. Our host is C. Steen Duckworth, and you can call in or Skype into this program by calling 1-646-668-2928 #1. Please make sure your surrounding area is quiet because this is a live program. One Sure Sign Mobile Notary of Frisco, Texas provides professional notary service across the Dallas metro area. Our notary professionals are ready to help you with loan closings, power of attorney, fingerprinting, and other notary services. We meet you at your location of choice, your home, office, hospital, or local coffee shop, convenient to your schedule. Reliable, professional, and affordable. One Sure Sign is happy to support Living Vertical Radio here in Texas. Mention you heard this ad on Living Vertical for $5 off any notary service. Interested in advertising on our podcast with a listening audience of over 800,000? You can do a 15-second business ad, a 30-second radio ad, or a 10-minute interview radio ad. Our prices start out at $50. Contact us at info@verticalmediagroup.com. Our pricing is made to give everyone the ability to advertising no matter the budget. Thank you. And here's your host, C. Steen Duckworth.
Good afternoon or late afternoon or evening for some people. This is Celeste Duckworth. And I welcome you to our program today. We have a great and interesting author. We have a little bit of echoing going on. I'm really not sure what's going on with our speakers today, but please just kind of bear with us. Today, our guest is John Dracup. He was born in Seattle, Washington, and he is a civil engineer and hydrologist. He holds a degree in civil engineering from the University of Washington, Seattle, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Cambridge, and the University of California in Berkeley. He has taught water resource engineering and hydrology at both the University of California, Los Angeles, and the University of California in Berkeley. Today, we're talking about his book, and I am so excited because I've been reading this book, and the name of the book is Clean Water for Developing Countries. You know, sometimes you get a book and you're like, okay, let's, you know, kind of go through this. But actually, this book is truly fascinating. We don't realize how important it is for clean water everywhere. And this is a really great book if you really want to understand it. So let's welcome our guest, John Dracup. Hi, John. How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you, and it's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's a pleasure
thank
to have you.
Sure.
Yeah, I, you know, I, several years ago, I was taking note to a couple of organizations that were providing clean water to the developing countries. And, I mean, your book is really, it really is fascinating. I've really been enjoying the book. So I got some great questions to ask you, so let's get right into it. So tell me about the book Clean Water for Developing Countries and why it's an impactful
groundwater for where you can dig a well, and surface water may be far away, but there is a great need for clean water in developing countries. For over 800,000. People in the world do not have access to clean water. This is some agencies like WHO say that it's up to over a million people that do not have access to clean water. That means their sources anywhere nearby are very polluted, or they're walking thousands of and hundreds of kilometers to find water. About over a million people, mostly children, die from waterborne diseases every year, mostly from either GI diarrhea type of illnesses. And I find this is an opportunity to give back because the world has been very good to me.
You know, as we go on with our conversation tonight, and as you know, and hopefully a lot of you will read even our continuing interview on our magazine. There's so many variables to consider. But tell me, in your upbringing, who or what influenced your love of civil engineering and hydrology?
You know, you're garbled a bit. Could you say that again?
Hold on just one second. In your upbringing, who or what influenced your love of civil engineering and hydrology?
Well, I grew up in Seattle, the Pacific Northwest, where there's a lot of water. And civil engineering has many different branches, soils, mechanics, structures. But one of them, of course, is water, which is water quality, clean water for cities that are drinking, clean water after its use and wastewater treatment, and then the actual supply of water through dams and reservoirs, et cetera. So non-governmental agencies have to provide the water for them.
Okay, I was, you know, when you talk about your travel and around the world and, you know, to teach and help bring these clean water projects, can you tell me which one was probably the most impactful to you, which country, which community that was probably the most impactful in you bringing this clean water project to them?
Well, there's an island in Lake Victoria, Kenya, called Remba Island. And the island was chosen by Rotary International. I belong to Rotary, which is a worldwide humanitarian group. They have 1.2 million members scattered in 34,000 clubs around the world. And because Kenya was the hotspot for HIV and AIDS in Africa, and this island, Remba Island, was a hotspot in Kenya. And this island, which is about twice the size of Alcatraz Island in 1,000 people on it, mainly fishermen. And this is described in my one of the case studies of chapter 16 in the book. And so over a three-year project, over a three-year time span, we were able to build this system that pumped water from the lake through filters into kiosks throughout the island. Now, the reason you think, well, why don't they use the water that surrounds the island? But it's polluted from the runoff from the island because they have open defecation. This system started, the work was started in January of 2011. The water started flowing in May of 2013. This was a seminal day for me because people came from, we gave the water free the first day, and the people came from all over the island and carried away this water in these jerry cans on their heads with smiles in their face.
Okay. So even, you know, in going to these different countries, one of the things I want to really compliment you on and take note of, and I was reading in your book, is that it's very important to, I'll say, respect the cultures of these different countries. So you do make a point of that. Tell me about community organizations. How important is it to create these organizations when you're bringing in a project for to clean water? And how important are they to continue the protocol in these countries to keep that water clean and to help reduce diseases in these countries?
Well, many cultural issues, but for example, we can't appreciate that some countries' people like the taste of their polluted water. Their grandparents, their parents have used it, and so it's not easy to convince people somehow that they should take this clean water. Also, part of the reason, well, we've been tasting chlorine all our lives, but most of these people in developing countries have never tasted chlorine, so they reject that. But one of the most important things that you touched on is you have to get the community involved. That's the first step. You need a water committee, a water sanitation and hygiene committee, which is WASH, and the committee has to have women on it. If you don't have women, it's going to fail. So you have this committee of maybe 10 to 12 people, and half of them will be women. And with them, you can work with them. You can't just come in and drop a system in and walk away. You have to get the community involved.
Why do you say it's important to have the women involved?
Well, in these developing countries, women do so much of the work. They gather the water, they cook, and they raise the children, and they are really in charge in many communities.
And so have you noticed, because I know you take a lot of students sometime and colleagues on these projects, what did you notice about them that may have changed their perspectives of working in other countries and the importance of what they're doing and bringing?
For the students, many of the graduate students, for example, at the University of California at Berkeley have worked in developing countries before. Some of them have been in Peace Corps, so they have knowledge of this. But everyone that goes and has this experience, for example, I took two groups of students to Honduras, and they come back changed, because a lot of Americans haven't seen poverty, the poverty that you have in these countries, and it's life-changing.
Okay. Yeah, that's so true. I think that when I'm reading your book and individuals that I do talk to in other countries, it's always interesting to see, you know, how different. Sometimes I feel that in America we have just a very one-sided perspective on how others live versus how we live here. And I will say we do take that for granted at times. So in teaching, how has teaching improved your career as a civil engineer and as a hydrologist?
Well, you learn a lot from your colleagues, you learn a lot from your students, and the teaching really gets the material ingrained into what you're doing, and you can then use this in teaching others in developing countries.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, I was reading one of the chapters, and it was interesting when you talk about how some of these projects fail. Can you give us a few examples of what would make a project fail?
And because there's many things that, first of all, as I said, you have to get the community involved. That's like the first thing you have to do. And you have to make them feel that this is their project, that their work that you're having them do, they have to help you build the project, that they really own it. It's sort of like, Humanities, Habitat for Humanities. Anybody gets a Habitat house has to do sweat labor. They have to be involved in it. So the community is one of the most important things. The other thing is, and there's many factors, is that people think they can give this away, and that's a big mistake. You cannot give free water away. You have to charge people a minimum amount. For example, if someone gives you theater tickets rather than you bought them yourself or to a sporting event, you're less apt to use that ticket than if you actually paid for it. So by paying for it, you appreciate it more. And all this comes under sustainability. Sustainability has to do with maintaining the system. You have to teach the local people how to maintain the system. And for example, if you're using membrane filters, they have to be backwashed, so people have to know the way to use the system.
You know, you made an interesting observation, and I hadn't thought about that before, but it's so true when you say people need to take ownership that you can't, and which is very true. You can't give everything away. I think it's very true when you're talking about Habitat for Humanity and some other organizations that I have worked with, that it's very true that you have to allow people to have ownership and to pay for some of the things of what they're doing, whether they're paying in sweat equity or actually paying for it. It does make a difference, and that's very true. In your 50 years plus of research, what is the one thing about water resource that you believe everyone should know?
Well, in the field for developing countries, people should know that we can clean up the dirtiest water. We have a technology to take whatever water we have and make it drinkable. People talk about toilets to taps or maybe showers to flowers. So the technology is there. The idea, though, is that village, every community is different, and you have to know what is the best technology for that particular village. And, for example, they have different quantities of water, different qualities of water. The village may be dispersed or maybe all together in one unit. They have different health needs, different education levels. And so it's not one size does not fit all. That's a real takeaway message here, that one size does not fit all, that everything is different, mm-hmm. and you need to train people and be trained yourself to do these systems.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now we want to talk about your process in writing this book, because even though this book is, I won't say technology-based, but it is in a way. What was your process you used to write the book, and do you plan to publish more books in Water and Supply?
Well, right now I'm busy trying to market this book. It just came out in January. And
right.
It's full in many places for sale. It's being distributed by Ingram Spark and also by Kindle Publishing, which is Amazon. So Kindle
mm-hmm.
Spark puts it out to 39,000 places around the world. But what really got me started on this, I took some short courses as a group in Canada called COST, which stands for Center for Appropriate Water and Sanitation Technology. They're located in Calgary, Canada. I took three courses there. I took a course from Potters for Peace, which is a group located in Wisconsin. They make potters, pottery that filters the water. But with COST, I found out there are five steps to providing clean water. Five technological steps. And these are the first five chapters of my book. And
mm-hmm.
they are the source has to be safe. The well has to be covered. So material from the surrounding area cannot get into it. You have to remove the sediment in the water. You look at water and it's dirty. You have to get that sediment out. And there's methods describing how to do that in the book. And then you have to filter the water. And I talk about biosand filters, membrane filters, ceramic filters. And this allows the water then to be disinfected by chlorine or sometimes by sunlight. And the last step, number five, is safe storage. You have to put it in a place where children can't dip their hands into the water. And has a tap.
Mm.
So those are
okay.
The first five chapters, and it gives you the approach. But it's not that alone, of course. It involves hygiene, washing hands, which we've heard so much about lately, cultural issues, marketing, and sustainability.
When you talk about the different types of filter, can you give us an idea of why there's the different types? Maybe give us two different types, and what is the when do you use them? Do you use them at the same? Because I understand what you're saying, that there's maybe different issues in different communities with the water. So why a membrane type filter versus another filter? How do you determine that?
Well, it comes down to cost and flow rate. Flow rate in the rest of the world uses liters per minute. We use maybe gallons per minute, but the flow rate has to be adequate. And the cost has to be very small. And so in the book, I talk about biosand filters, which were developed by a professor, Mans, in the University of Calgary in Calgary, Alberta. And it's actually a column of sand and gravel that filters the water it goes through, and they're described in great detail in the book. They're used all over the world, and probably over a million are out there, and various non-NGOs, which are non-governmental organizations, will have these type of filters. A ceramic filter is a pot. And Potters for Peace, for example, is a group that advocates this. They're very inexpensive. They're maybe, I've seen them for sale in Kenya for $17 each, but they have a very low flow rate, 2 to 3 liters per hour. So there's a trade-off here in a high flow rate, such as you get the membrane filter. The membrane filters in Remba Island would go like 500 liters per hour compared to 2 or 3 liters. But you get into a situation like Remba Island, where you have thousands of people there, you need a lot of flow rate, high flow rate, and which, of course, is more expensive.
Okay. So do we have in our country, in the United States, issues with our water that we could improve upon?
Well, most of the water sources in the United States are very drinkable. For example, Consumer Report in the 1980s rated the water systems in America, I think it was 1988, that those documents are still available. They rated the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power water that comes from the Owens Valley as the number one water source in the world. But every community, every water district has a report. And if you go onto their website and ask for a water quality report, you'll see what kind of water you have. Some water sources have arsenic in it, even low amounts. 10 parts per billion is the allowable amount. But and some water sources have high amounts of salt, and they call this total dissolved solids. And for example, the Colorado River has about 800 total dissolved solids or parts per million, while the Owens Valley might be 50. But this information is available to everyone from their local water district. There are, of course, problems. They had the lead problem in Flint, Michigan, which is unfortunate. But it's all about money and determination. As I said before, we have the technology to do that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. If someone wanted to contribute to some of these organizations that are creating clean water in other countries, how would they go about doing that? Do you have a certain organization that you like or prefer, or how would they donate to some projects?
Well, there's many organizations around in various levels, and these are called non-governmental organizations. Some of the big ones are the Red Cross, of course, World Vision, the Catholic Relief Organization, water.org. If you just Google clean water for developing countries, you'll get thousands of these. And a lot of this in chapter 16 of my book, where I do 16 case studies, many of these organizations are listed. And then on chapter 17, I have a resource guide, and the resource guide gives more of these organizations. So,
perfect.
And I mentioned, of course, Rotary Foundation, Rotary International, which is one.
Right.
And they're large and they're small. Some of them are very small. There's a group in South Carolina called the Water Missions, which has their own unique water system. There's many of these around. And a lot of churches support these organizations.
Okay. Well, I will say that I've enjoyed the book, and I'm not even, you know, I've enjoyed the book because it's an easy read, and it's really great information. So why should people buy this book, and who is it for?
Well, as I mentioned, it's for anybody who's interested in clean water and for developing countries. I would say it was two groups. People just want to be informed about the subject and learn about how to go about it, so they're actually out there working and doing it, doing these type of projects.
Okay. So where can readers stay connected with you?
Well, I have an email, dracup@berkeley.edu. My last name is spelled D-R-A-C-U-P at Berkeley. Berkeley is where the city in which the University of California, Berkeley, is located, and where I'm now an emeritus professor.
Okay.
And they also, there's a website, of course, for the book, and it's www.cleanwaterbook.com, all one word, www.cleanwaterbook.com. There's a website for it. And I'm looking forward to correspondence with people. Of course, it's for sale on Amazon and many other sites.
And we will make sure that we add those links to Vertical Life magazine for any of you interested in being able to purchase the book. And I always ask this of any of authors, John, is what's your next project?
Well, my next project is marketing the book, which I find is more difficult than writing it. But I have no other book in mind right now, but I might write a couple of years from now, I might write a memoir for my family. But right now I'm challenged by marketing it, and I'm doing the best I can.
Okay. Well, I've enjoyed talking to you, John. I really appreciate you being on our program, and I really appreciate you writing this book. It's a great insight to what other countries are going through, and it's just knowing that there's people that are going there and advocating for clean water is great. So we appreciate you in that respect. I just want to say that anyone that's listening, our readers, you can find this book on Amazon, Clean Water for Developing Countries by John Dracup. And I have two copies. If you're interested in having a copy, if you contact me through at Living Vertical Radio, the first two people that contact me and say, "Hey, I want this book," I will send this book to you. So,
okay, great.
That's the best. Yeah, I will send this book to you so you can read it. So get in touch with me and you will get a copy of this book. Thank you again, John, for being with us. I really appreciate you being here. We will be looking for, you can be looking for some more questions that we asked John on Vertical Life Magazine. We will post that link in the next few days, and you'll get a chance to read a little bit more. You know, see a few more questions from John. Again, John, thank you, and have a great evening. We appreciate you.
Well, thank you. Good night.
Thank you. Good night. And thank you, our readers, and thank you to Living Vertical, to all of our individuals who have helped us put these programs together. I'd like to leave a note that, you know, we are sponsoring an Ireland Writers Retreat. We have moved the date, and we will be catching up on giving that information out. If you're interested in still going, we have a couple of seats left, so we will be posting that in the next few days. Again, this has been Living Vertical Radio, and we thank everyone for coming out today and hearing our interview with John Draca. Have a great evening.